time away from Rabbi Brander, other than to say that the relationship between the Gruz Kollel and Boca has been a very, very special symbiotic relationship. And in many respects, Rabbi Brander was able to enable the Gruz graduates, the Gruz alumni, to find themselves, each of them, in terms of their unique potential, and that's a very, very special skill. And I just want to wish him, as a give a Birkat Hedyot, that in his new position, he will also be able to continue to not only his own personal Avodas Hashem, but also to orchestrate the Avodas Hashem of others.
Thank you. Rishus Rav Miller and Rishus will be there here today. I want to just first of all thank you for the opportunity of being able to share words of Torah with you. And what I'd like to do is basically to interact and discuss with you an issue that I had the opportunity of presenting at a conference yesterday, and that is to deal with certain halachic issues of in vitro fertilization. Now, I think these halachas are very important halacha lemaisa issues. I don't think there's any rav that will have any pulpit that won't deal with them. So I think it's important that we understand them, the halacha context, and discuss some of the issues dealing with in vitro fertilization. Now, as I'm doing this, I realized that the last group I gave this to were all scientists and doctors and stuff like that, so they understood what IVF is. Does anyone know what in vitro fertilization is here? Does anyone? Okay. Why don't I just like take 2 seconds to can I erase this? Is this okay? Essentially, example of trying to draw a woman's anatomy, but essentially what basically happens here is normally what happens is that eggs are released from the ovaries, and a woman has, actually when a woman is born, she has the same amount of eggs that she's going to have for the rest of her life, which has a very important halachic ramifications on certain issues. And what happens is that every month an egg is released, and there's 1 month it's from one set of ovaries, one month it's from the other set, and this is the fallopian tube. And if you look at the Gemara, Cheder, Pruzder, Aliyah, they all represent different parts of the anatomy. But essentially what happens is, let's say an egg is released over here, and then what will happen is sperm will travel, and if the egg is fertilized, it will fertilize here, and then it will develop. And at the stage which is known as blastocyst, which is maybe 3 to 5 days, will develop into multicells, and eventually it will implant on the uterine lining, right over here in the uterine lining. And then in the uterine lining, it will begin to nurture and develop into a fetus, and eventually into a baby. What happens is that the uterine lining continues to grow so that it can provide the blood and all the sustenance for the fertilized egg. But if the egg is not fertilized, this is sloughed away, and that's how a woman has her period. And essentially that lining is removed, and that's what the dam of the period is. Now what happens is when there is relations, millions of sperm are released, and there are several different blockages that only basically allow very few sperm to get into this area, and only one to fertilize the egg. So it's like I was traveling on the FDR Drive last week, And, you know, there are a lot of potholes along the way. So there are basically a lot of different potholes along the way here. And what happens is that millions of sperm are destroyed on their way to fertilizing this one egg. What happens if a man doesn't have enough sperm? So essentially what happens is sperm will not reach here, or the sperm is not well developed. Or what happens if a woman is not expressing her eggs properly so that there isn't the opportunity to fertilize the egg here? Now normally what happens is there's a whole bunch of different protocols that can be done before you do what we're going to discuss. Sometimes the fallopian tubes are closed. That could be because a woman had her appendix taken out and there's scar tissue that's closed them. And there are certain procedures, and this is not the time to go through all those procedures, simple procedures that can cause them to simply be opened up again. Sometimes a woman has, Rahman al-Islam, she might be going through cancer treatments. Radiation will destroy the eggs in the ovaries, the oocytes, really, unfertilized eggs in the ovaries. So sometimes what you might want to do is, since the eggs are waiting here, you stimulate them to the point in which you basically then take out a whole section of them and then freeze them somewhere. So when the woman wants to have a child, you can take some of those eggs that were frozen and put somewhere else. You can actually freeze oocytes at the present time. So there are certain challenges that can happen so that the natural way in which a couple has a child, sometimes if that doesn't happen, there are other ways to help. The simplest way of helping is what's called IUI, intrauterine insemination, IUI. And what happens basically is that instead of the sperm having to travel on the FDR drive here and have all the potholes so they can't get to this point in which they fertilize the egg, you basically take a syringe, which is very small, so there's no petichas kever issue or anything else of that nature, and you basically shoot the sperm in here, so the sperm has a shortcut, doesn't have to travel all this way, and therefore all the potholes along the way are obviated. That's the simplest way. It's called IUI. But sometimes IUI doesn't work, and then what happens is you have IVF. IVF is in vitro fertilization, where the fertilization does not happen in the fallopian tube, but in a lab. And what happens is you take the man's sperm, and you take an egg, and you have the man's sperm. And what happens is that one of the sperms will basically hit the egg, fertilize it, and then what happens is you pick two or three of the fertilized eggs that look good, based on a whole bunch of different techniques. One is known as PGD, which is basically a way of checking for certain genetic things before you return the egg into the uterine wall, and then it develops, please God, in the host mother or the gestational mother, and a child is born. Sometimes if a person doesn't have even effective sperm, there will be what's called ICSI IVF, which means that you take a syringe and you shoot a sperm into the egg to cause immediate fertilization. It's called ICSI IVF. I'm not going to get into, this is really, IVF for dummies right now. It's just a basic, very fast overview, not to suggest God forbid anyone here is, I'm just using that, those books, take foot out of mouth here. And also this PGD issue, just to bring down a very important halachic issue right now is, PGD basically is there to be able to check for certain genetic disorders. And actually, you should just know that Israel is way more advanced in these issues than even America is on IVF and PGDs and stuff like that. It's half the cost. Rabbi Nachum Bernstein has always discussed the idea that the Ministry of Tourism should have an advertisement. Come to Israel and have a child and see the sites, and basically, of course, you half the price than doing it in America. But PGD can do another thing also, is that it can help you decide, it can tell you whether the fertilized egg, it will be a male or female. So one of the shilas that is out there now and being discussed, whether you can do this PGD test and decide whether you want to implant a male or a female back in there to fulfill the obligation of Furuvu and things of that nature. Are you permitted to use the PGD technology to decide whether, I have four girls at home, I want to have a boy. I have five boys at home, I want to have a girl. Not that I don't think IVF is permitted when a person already has five children, but I'm just, giving you an example. And by the way, that there is now a protocol in Israel that allows PGD to use for selecting male or female that is now covered by insurance in Israel. So it's a serious issue. My issue that I want to discuss and what is the following. When this IVF procedure is done, where the fertilization does not happen in the natural location, but in a laboratory, is there any issues regarding the definition of who the father and who the mother is? And what happens if the woman, she has the ability from a physiological perspective to carry a woman, but for some reason she has no eggs. She has no eggs, or none of her eggs are functional. So she wants an egg from somebody else. Who's the mother of the child? The one who donated the genetics, the genetic donor, or the host mother? Who's the mother of the child? And who's the father? If you don't do the natural act of bia, and you just give the sperm in another way, are you still considered the father? Those are the halachic issues that I'd like to discuss. And then, if we have a few minutes, even though I don't think we will, to discuss the halachas dealing with Shabbos here. Because what is permitted on Shabbos? Let's say you stimulate these follicles to the point in which that they're ready to extract them on Shabbos. You know, that's Oker Dover Migadulo. We can have a whole discussion of which Av Malacha it is, but it's most probably an Av Malacha, whether it's, you know, whatever one it is, we can have a discussion about it. Is that permitted on Shabbos in any way? Is there any halacha of a woman who is unable to have a child? Is she considered a chola? What type of chola is she considered? She needs shots, hormonal shots on Shabbos. Is she permitted to have hormonal shots on Shabbos? Who's permitted to give her the shots? You know, there's a whole battery of Hilchos Shabbos questions that go into all these issues of infertility and halacha. If you will have a pulpit, I promise you that this will be an issue that you'll have to deal with. Okay? So let's open up the first page of our handout here. Time is not going to allow us to go through each source inside, and I'm just going to, a lot of them, I'm just going to, I don't have to, 12:45, right? So I have a half an hour to do something that should take a few hours. So I'm basically going to give you a very fast overview of this. The first page actually indicates the whole idea, and there has to be a certain recognition that there's nothing wrong with us being involved in this type of science. That there's nothing wrong with us trying to be involved in tikkun olam. The world was not created perfect. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be his partner. And the first source there is the Medrash, which reminds us of the fact that everything that was created in this world, whether it's through the notion of Mila or anything else of that nature, there is this celebration of the idea of tikkun, of that there needs to be complete achieving of perfection, and that complete achieving of perfection can be done by humankind, and I believe that these types of scientific protocols celebrate those ideas. The next is a Gemara, which Rabbi Soloveitchik used to discuss many times, a very famous argument between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva, where Turnus Rufus says the reason why Jews go to Gehenna is because they help the poor. Because let's say a king decides that his subjects will not have food to eat or drink, and what happens is someone sneaks food to the subject that has been incarcerated, food to eat or drink, would not the king punish the person who snuck food into the person who he said can have food to eat or drink? By you helping the poor, says Turnus Rufus, you are going against the rule, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted, and the Jewish people are considered the servants of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rabbi Akiva said, suppose a king incarcerates his son and says no one should give his son food to eat or drink. Would not the king be happy if someone actually goes against his rule and gives his son food to eat or drink? And we are called the children of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Banim atem l'Hashem Elokecha. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say that the argument here is a philosophical argument, and that is, what type of glasses do we wear as human beings? Turnus Rufus says, we wear the glasses of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We view the world through the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted this person to be poor, we can't get involved. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted this person not to have children, we can't get involved. Rabbi Akiva says, no, we don't wear the glasses of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We can't decide what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. We don't understand what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. We wear the glasses of being partners with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. We wear the glasses of being agents of change.
of being agents of change within the parameters of halacha, but being proactive agents of change. We don't wear the glasses of the Kodesh Baruch Hu. We don't take a providential view of things. The Meiri tells us in Sanhedrin that in discussing the issues of Kishuv, he mentions in a tangential comment, which I've highlighted for you, that there's actually will be a time in which people might learn how to create human beings not through the natural act that is a normal way. And as long as this is based on science, one should not think that it is forbidden to be involved in it, but rather, once it's based in science and not in magic, it is a halakhically sanctioned opportunity to be involved in. Now, just because science has created this opportunity doesn't mean that a couple has to do this in order to have children. A couple is responsible to have the mitzvah pru revu of trying to have children, but they don't have to go to these heroic measures in order to be able to do it. It's difficult to go through a process of IVF. It's psychologically difficult. It's physically difficult. There is some limited risk, which is another halachic issue which we're not going to be able to touch, about when you can be involved in limited risk. There's a Shavuos Yaakov and a few other tshuvas on that issue. But the bottom line is, we learn from the halachas of Karban Pesach, where an Arel had an excuse not to go through the action of Mila, that we don't require an Arel whose brother died, or there's other reasons that he doesn't have Mila. We don't require him to do a heroic activity to have Mila, even though by not doing this heroic activity, he won't fulfill the mitzvah of Karban Pesach. We don't require a husband and wife to go through this heroic activity of IVF in order to have children, even though they won't be able to fulfill the mitzvah of Pru Revu, or the larger mitzvah of Shevet Zetzora. Even if they can't fulfill those mitzvahs, we don't require them to go through this heroic activity. But one should recognize that science is there, and it's our responsibility as firm Jews, it's our responsibility as leaders of future leaders of Klal Yisrael, to understand how halacha deals with those issues. So let's go to the next page. On the next page, we're introduced to the notion of how do you define a father. And I'm gonna tell you the end, and I'll just show you how it works into the different poskim. But according to most poskim, there's not total consensus to this, but according to the vast majority of poskim, a definition of a father is the sperm donor. It's irrelevant regarding whether there was a maisa bia or not. Now, a maisa bia is important for other issues. For example, let's say the sperm that came to this woman, that was donated to this woman, comes from someone that if she has bia with, there's an issa kares or anything else of that nature. Is there an issue of mamzerus when sperm comes from someone if you had a sexual act with, there would be an issue of mamzerus? So there's a nafkamina that Rav Moshe makes, that Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach basically makes, that essentially, in order to have the status of mamzerus, it's not enough just to have a sperm donation, but you mamish have to have the sexual act itself. There has to be kiruv basar in order to have that. So there is a difference between the two. But for our discussion here, the notion of paternity is basically a sperm donor. We see that in a few different places. First, it's highlighted initially in a pasuk in Megillas Esther, where it seems that Esther is introduced. The language is verbose, and since the language is verbose, the Gemara learns from that language that essentially that Esther's father died the minute after there was conception. So Esther's father wasn't even alive when Esther was born, and nevertheless, it's called her father. So the Gemara learns from there that we see that you don't have to be alive for the birth of your child. The father doesn't have to be alive for the birth of the child, or even for the gestational process, in order to be called father. This idea is further highlighted in more expansion when we're introduced to the idea of a basula that became pregnant, and can she still marry a kohen gadol? And we suggest that there is the possibility of a psula to become pregnant without having a maisa bia. That's the Gemara in Chagiga. And that she could still marry a Kohen Gadol, where she was fertilized, where she was inseminated in a different way. The example here is through a bath that had sperm in it. But again, not dealing with the exact, the Gemara here is creating appropriate paradigms that we can learn from. And the idea is that the Gemara already highlights, way before science discussed it, the idea of being able to be inseminated without having a maisabia. The Beis Shmuel on the first siman in Eben Ezer says that if you have a situation where a man contributed his sperm without the maisabia, he's still considered the father l'chol davar, he's mekayim the mitzvah of puravu, etc., etc., etc. And that's the reason why a woman should never lie on sheets in which another man has been on, because maybe sperm would travel into her and there might be a problem of yuchsin and other things of that nature. Without getting into the science of that, again, the paradigm that the halacha is trying to create is that a sperm donor has a paternal relationship. This idea is highlighted in a tshuva from the Tashbeis, an excellent, unbelievable, interesting tshuva. We don't have time to read the tshuva inside. You can read it on your own time. It highlights everything that I just said, and that is that the sperm donor is halachically the father. The Minchas Yitzchak, not known for his left-wing tendencies, has concretizes also that in cases of IVF and IUI, that the sperm donor is the father, fulfills the mitzvah of puravu l'chol davar. His concern, and his concern is extremely important, not one taken serious enough outside of Eretz Yisrael, is that sometimes, in order to make sure that this happens in the lab properly, you might not protect the man's sperm properly, and we don't know whose sperm is being fertilized by the woman, whose sperm is being fertilizing the woman's egg, and he reminds everybody that there needs to be appropriate shmirah in the laboratories, so to make sure that the sperm and the egg of the couple are being used, and not that the sperm is being doctored to somebody else. Yes?
I know this is not really on the topic, but if you spend just 30 seconds to talk about the issue of what's there, well, how are you getting this?
So since there's not a issue of motzi shechazer levatala, because it's being used in order to be able to be mekayim the mitzvah puravu. That's what the Minchas Yitzchak says. That's what Rav Shlomo Zalman discusses. Hashkashas being motzi shechazer levatala is when it's not when your end goal isn't to fulfill one of two mitzvahs, the mitzvah of ona, the mitzvah of puravu. Here the mitzvah is to fulfill the mitzvah of puravu, and therefore it's not considered motzi shechazer levatala. There's actually two different ways in which labs in Israel deal with the motzi shechazer levatala. There's the Yerushalayim way, there's the B'nai Brak way. Yerushalayim actually, the husband and wife actually normally have relations with a condom that has no spermicide in it, and then the condom is brought to the lab. And actually in B'nai Brak, it's done slightly differently, where there's a room in which the man expresses his sperm. There's actually two different ways it's done, and actually in Yerushalayim, there's actually there's a whole infrastructure that was created for people who live in the Yishuvim, that if they had the relationship between husband and wife, the sperm would not be strong enough to do the work. So there's actually certain protocols how to handle it with tznius in Yerushalayim, which I don't want to get into all the details now, but it's been done in a very sensitive way under the flag of Machon Puah. It's really done all the work. Towards that end, if you turn to the next page of the handout, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, in a very important article, which I'm just giving you the summary of, highlights the idea of taking, by the way, he deals with Chutzah Shechazer Levatala immediately in the first summary page, and here he brings down, even if this insemination has to happen during the time where the woman is a nida. In other words, normally, you know, we don't have relations with our spouses while they're nida. There's even the Gemara speaks about a person being conceived while you're a nida. And by the way, in cases where you trust the couple, I tell the woman to go to the mikvah even if it's during her days of nidas. They're doing the IUI because it destroys any nida daraisa issues, and then you wait the appropriate amount of days for her to go to the mitzvah again, where then she could have an intimate relationship with her husband. And sometimes those days are postponed. I'm throwing out a whole bunch of new ideas here due to the notion of poleta shivcha zera, which might require some additional days of waiting. I don't know where you're holding in these sugyas. I'm just throwing out some ideas that you should just be aware of. So Rav Shlomo Zalman reminds us that it's permitted to do it. He reminds us also about not using zera of any other person because it's the paternal one. And you have the famous tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, which he took a lot of flack for. And that is because Rav Moshe Feinstein and others are so committed to this idea of the sperm donor is the person who gives the father is a sperm donor, when the husband does not have sperm, he does not want sperm to come from any other source than a non-Jewish source. Rav Moshe wants you to use non-Jewish sperm in order to make sure there's no yichud issues. And therefore, Rav Moshe Feinstein will do it. By the way, here's a case where PGD would come out. Let's say there's a Kohen. He has no sperm. And he has no sperm, and they're going to do IVF with a guy's sperm. The child born is not going to be a Kohen. How is he going to explain it to all his friends? So there are some people, this is a Shiloh. Can you use PGD so that the fertilized eggs that you return are only female eggs, only females, so that the person will be spared the embarrassment of having to explain to his friends that, you know, this issue? And that's a halakhic question that's been raised. And there are several people who have weighed in on the issue, and they're actually, the tshuvas are available at Machon Pua on this issue. But I'm just giving you an example of when this PGD thing would come, you know, just to put it in context. So to summarize, we've seen that the notion of paternity is basically defined by the sperm donor. There's one other issue here that I want to mention. That's on the next page of your handout. And that is, what about, and the Note of Yehuda in the 1700s gives you a window into it. And I articulated this window at the conference. Not everybody was embraced the window as completely as I try to open it. But and I want to be intellectually honest here, but I think it's an unbelievable insight. The Navi Buddha asked the following question. If a woman loses her husband without children, we know there's the issue of Yivan L'Chalitza. You wait 90 days to see if the woman is pregnant, and then you do, you know, Yivan, or now you do Chalitza. So the Navi Buddha says, why don't you wait 93 days? Maybe right before he died, he had relations with his wife. It takes 3 days for the sperm to fertilize the egg over here. And so you should wait 93 days. So there's a whole bunch of people that deal with this too. So most of them say, you know, we round it off to 90. The Note of Yehuda says the following. The Note of Yehuda says, you have to look at the pasuk. The pasuk says, Ubein ein la, that she, what's the pasuk again? Ubein ein lo, that there's no child to him. If at the point of death, she is not with child, even if she becomes pregnant from his sperm after he dies, she is required to go through the process of chalitza. In other words, if they had relations 5 minutes before he died, and there's sperm in her right over here, and it fertilizes her eggs 3 days after he died, she's still chayav in yivan chalitza because ubein ein lo at the point in which he died. But then the Navi Yehuda says something that's unbelievable. And here's the window I try to open. Maybe this says, while Yivan Chalitza are mandated, but the child that is born posthumously is his child, l'chol davar, is his child for everything. So I wanted to suggest from this Note of Yehuda that here we are even introduced that sperm that is donated posthumously, there's still a relationship between the father and the child. A guy gives of his sperm, he's going through cancer treatments, gives of his sperm beforehand, and Rahman al-Tzlan does not succeed through those treatments, and the wife wants to have a child. Not that I would encourage something like this, but one wants to have a child to remember her husband, and gives the sperm posthumously, and the guy's a Kohen, is the child a Kohen. And I'd like to suggest from this, because he says, Vin Kang, what I put in a box here, Ani Omer, Isha Shalo Kolta Zera Kolam Misas Abala Avsha Kolta Achamoso Ubenohu Lechol Davar. There's a slight flaw in my presentation here. I want to be because there's still an act that happens while they're alive, their act of cohabiting together, but I would suggest that the act of donating the sperm while he's still alive replaces that act, and therefore this could be a raya, that there's a relationship to posthumous paternity. You can take it or leave it. There are people who use this note of Yehuda to prove the point, and there are people who don't agree with it. But I'm just mentioning it. What about the mother? Who's the mother?
Why is that like this with everything you've been saying, that goes according to the Zohar?
Right, I agree with you. But so, I want to be intellectually honest. And people say that's one thing when the person's alive that he gave Zera, but after he dies, to take the Zera from a bank and suggest that, you know, the guy's dead for 20 years, or for that matter, Zera can be stored for 100 years, and all of a sudden there's a grandchild saying Kaddish for his father that lived, you know, you can create Star Trek science here that can be very complicated. It's not just a simple thing that you're saying here. I mean, your momish can store sperm for many, many years, and you can have a child born you know, 50 years after the father was no longer in this world, was saying Kaddish for a father, or had maybe a relationship to the Yerusha. There's a whole bunch of different parents. By making the statement that there's a relationship posthumously, you open up a whole can of worms that we don't have time to deal with in a half an hour. But I'm just letting you, this is a very brief overview of a very important halakhic issue. Yes?
Is that the same thing in terms of determination of fatherhood?
It's Sitz Eliezer says that since there's no, he's the only one that I'm aware of, that Sitz Eliezer says that there's no father. Because that's what Sitz Eliezer says. But he's the only one who says it. Everybody else, unlike the maternity issue, which I left for last, which is much more complicated, it sits to the best of my knowledge, and if anyone knows differently, I can say, I think everybody else feels that the definition of the father is the sperm donor. That's really accepted by everybody. What about the mother? Now, in the case where the mother is, the egg and the womb comes from the same mother, then other than the Sitz Eliezer, who also suggests that maybe there's no mother here, everybody else suggests that the mother is the mother. She's the genetic donor of the egg. She's the gestational mother, and that's good enough. However, what about when the egg and the gestational mother are two different people? There you start having a whole bunch of shilas, and you have some people that say there are two mothers now, that they're both mothers. You have some that say there are no mothers. It's Sitz Eliezer. And then you have some that say it's the genetic donor. That's in the Ada Haredis world, that's what they have been saying, was genetic mother. And actually, Rav Goren wrote a tshuva that says it's genetic mother. I would suggest that this is probably the only time that it had similar views on anything. But they've said it. And there's a few others that say it also. Read Tchumim volume, the fifth volume. There's a whole bunch of discussions on this issue. But the majority of the poskim, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and even Rav Yashiv hints to it, which we'll read and stuff like that, seems that the definition of maternity is not the genetic donor, but rather the nurturing agent, the gestational mother, or the host mother. But the one that hosts the fetus is the one that's defined as the mother. But clearly, there is no full consensus, but the majority of the poskim say that it's the mother who is the gestational mother. She is the one that is the mother self. And I want to develop that perspective with the recognition that there are different shitas, and I actually bring down a few of them just to have a few. So let's spend a few minutes on this. There's a very famous Targum Yonasan Ben Uziel, which is very hard to bring down from a halakhic perspective, but Rabbi Yisraeli does on the next page of your handout, and that is that apparently when Rachel and Leah were pregnant at the same time, and when Leah was pregnant with, when Leah was pregnant with Dinah and Rachel was pregnant with Yosef, that's not exactly what happened, according to the Targum Yonasan Ben Uziel, but rather Leah realized that she was pregnant with a boy, and Rachel was pregnant with Dinah, and that Rachel would have had less boys, less shvatim than even the maidservants. She prays to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, Leah, that her sister should have equal amount of, at least to the maidservants, and there is an interuterine change, in which what happens is that the fetus of Rachel is moved into the womb of Leah, and the fetus of Yosef is moved into the womb of Rachel. And that's what the Targum Yonatan Ben Uzziel says on the bottom of page 5. And Rav Shaul Yisraeli shows that as a proof. Again, it's a little hard to use that as a proof. Shows that as a proof that the definition of maternity is not where the egg is conceived, but rather who develops the fetus during the gestational period. Perhaps a stronger proof is the Gemara in Yavamas, where the Gemara in Yavamas discusses the idea of different permutations of twins. Twins that are born and after they're born are converted, obviously don't have a halakhic relationship. There's no issue of yibum, of chalitza, of eishes ach. What about twins that are conceived in a non-Jewish womb, but the woman converts during the process of her pregnancy? So there the Mishnah says, there's no yibum and chalitza, but there is an issue of eishes ach. Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg uses this as a proof text to suggest, hey, why is it that there's no yibum and chalitza, but there's still an issue of eishes ach? He says, I know why, because yibum and chalitza are connected to the father. When is that relationship started? When the sperm was donated. When the sperm was donated, they weren't Jewish. So when the conversion happens while they're pregnant, so that relationship is severed on some level, and therefore there's no yibum chalitza relationship between the two children, the two twins in utero. There's no longer yibum chalitza relationship, but eishes ach is predicated on the woman, and therefore that relationship is continuing through the gestational development. So therefore, when the tevila happens, the relationship between the children and the mother has not yet been formalized, and therefore that relationship is not severed. The only relationship that is severed is a relationship that has been fully developed, and therefore there's no yibum and chalitza. That's what Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg uses as one of his two proofs. There's one other proof that's a little bit more complicated. We won't get into that. But then you have, if you turn to the next page, you have Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who has an unbelievable, as only Rav Aaron would say it. He basically says, look at the egg as made in Japan. Look at the egg as having, those are his words, look at the egg as having no halakhic relevance at all, because anything that severs this relationship during the first 40 days, where it's called maya ba'alma, should not be considered should not have halakhic standing. And therefore, since the egg donor is during the pre-40-day period, the first 40 days of the fetus are viewed as maya ba'alma, to the point in which there's a shaila about whether you could be mahalo Shabbos for a fetus that's less than 40 days old, and the Ramban's answer that it's better to violate one Shabbos in order that it can celebrate many Shabbatot is based on the recognition of the fact that even though there are different stages of giving it human attributions, the fetus, at different stages of development, as the Rambam does when he calls it kerodes in other places, that the pre-40-day period, it's not considered a human being at any level. And therefore, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says any donation made in the pre-40-day period, which is detached from things that happen after the 40-day period, from the egg's perspective, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik refuses to acknowledge. And therefore, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, which is a little hard to understand because the sperm is donated during the first 40 days also, but Rav Aaron Soloveitchik basically says, says that therefore the egg donor has no maternal relationship with this child. It's only the mother involved in the fetal development. And if you look at the Nishmat Avram, you'll see that Rav Yashiv, who's very concerned about doing IVF for a whole bunch of different reasons, but his concern is mainly when the egg comes from a different person than the womb, not when the procedure happens itself. He also says that he thinks it's the yoledes that's the aim, and the same thing is true even with the Tzitz Eliezer, who's not happy with this at all, also says the same thing. So it seems to be that most people hedge their bets, so to say, as to suggest that it's the gestational mother, based on that Gemara and Yavamas, Pace and other things, that it's the gestational mother. However, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg says, listen, there is a really good reason to believe that it's the person that donates the genetic material. So Rav Zalman Nechemya says that when the genetic material comes from a non-Jew, you should do, in other words, if the mother who's developing the fetus is a non-Jew, everybody says you should do gayrus. But what happens if the eggs come from a non-Jew, from a Gaia? What's the halacha then? So if Aaron Soloveitchik says you don't do conversion at all because we don't care about who gave the eggs. But even Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, who through his whole article is articulating that it's the mother who develops the fetus that's the mother, he'll say we have to be concerned about this shita, and therefore gayrus has to be done misafeg. And in cases that I've been involved in, I've always followed that, because who am I to decide which shita is right? Why should I make a decision? What happens, you know, if there's a young lady that's born, and she's born in the case where the eggs came from a non-Jew, and I don't do conversion because I follow Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. And then the girl becomes 20 years old, 22 years old, and she happens at that point not to be religious in her life. She went away from religion. And now she wants to marry a Jew. And 22 years from now, they've decided that they want to follow the approach that the egg donor is the definition of a mother. I've just basically closed an avenue for her because I didn't do the conversion when the parents were from and they were making sure that she was educated properly and everything else like that. So I think there's nothing wrong with doing a gerus misafek. And if we posken that you don't need the gerus, it won't affect her ability to marry a kohen. And so it was just a dump in the mikvah. It's not, you know, I haven't done anything. What I've done basically is hedge my bet in an appropriate way in order to make sure all different poskim are honored.
Why should she be allowed to marry a kohen?
If it's a gayrus misafik and we pass it at the end, she didn't need the gayrus, and I didn't do brachas or anything else like that, so then it wasn't anything. Right, my issue is that in 20 years from now, when let's say the poskim are more familiar with they're familiar with these issues now, but there's more consensus because there's more time, and they come to the conclusion that, like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, that you don't have to worry about the egg donor, so then I didn't do anything to destroy her ability to marry a kohen. Because what I did was an act that wasn't necessary. That's my point. Yes?
Should preference be that the egg be given by a goya?
So then the whole question about that, about yichus, about whatever. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu has a pecking order of what he would like, and I believe his pecking order first is a single Jewish woman before going to a goya, for the reasons that we just mentioned of the status of the child. And then you just have to basically know who that family is, or know the birth date of the genetic mother, or some other sign, so that if there is, you know, so you become careful 20 years later. But I'm, you know, with some certainty, I'm sure that Rav Mordechai Eliyahu's preference is a single Jewish woman before a Gaia. On the final page, you have Rav Shlomo Zalman's comment that I said to you, and that is that even though he says everything I just said, that it's the gestational mother, he says that the egg came from a Gaia, gayrus should be done. And then you have a different approach, and there's others who follow this also, that suggest that it is the Beit Seat that defines it's the egg that defines the maternity and not the gestational mother. The purpose of me wanting to share words of Torah with you is the following. Number one is, I think it's very important that these issues like this be introduced to us, because eventually we're going to, for two reasons. Hashgafically, I think it's important that we realize that the beauty of Torah, and you know, there's a famous drasha, the Beis HaLevi, drasha Yitches, that speaks about the responsibility that we have to develop Torah in its appropriate venues. The beauty of Torah is it embraces all modern issues of science, and that we have to find ways of embracing all these issues. We can't retreat from those issues. We need to be on that halakhic frontier. And we have to make sure that we are, and we have to make sure that Das Torah is involved with these halakhic issues. The second thing is that anyone who's going to have pulpits, whether in Eretz Yisrael or anywhere outside of Eretz Yisrael, I guarantee you that you will deal with these issues. And he should have some familiarity with them, a lot more in depth than what I've done with you today. And the third thing is that you know, I wanted, you know, and hopefully I'll get to know you all better, both here in Eretz Yisrael and for those of you who will be coming back to America, both in America. And I didn't want to introduce myself through just sharing with you what the vision of this Center for the Jewish Future is and how it's impacting on the agenda of YU and its commitment to Klal Yisrael, both in Eretz Yisrael and outside of Eretz Yisrael, but I wanted our relationship to be one that begins and hopefully will continue with Torah. Because ultimately, that's, I think, the most important common denominator that we share, the ability to interact in areas of Torah, and hopefully together, you know, I told Rabbi Miller, this is the most important foreign team for Yeshiva University, the guys who come to the Gros Kollel, and that I have had the privilege of, and I, you know, with the help of Rabbi Miller, of taking advantage of the of this foreign team, of the guys from here in Boca, and there have been a lot. Not only has the Gros Kollel built the Boca community, which it really has, but the Gros Kollel has helped create very important initiatives. When out of the Boca Kollel, there were people who went on to develop other institutions because of the influences that they had from the Gros Kollel. The Gros Kollel has really created serious roots in a whole bunch of different communities around the country and around Eretz Yisrael. You have Rabbanim here, Rabbi Schneider, you have Rabbi Fass and others that benefited from the Gros experience, even if they didn't go to Gros. They benefited from the Gros experience because the Boca Kollel really was nurtured from Gros. It was the gestational feeder for I had to figure out a way of connecting the two. Gestational feeder for, and it really made a difference in the future of Boca. Gros Kollel made that difference. And while maybe what Rabbi Miller says has some truth to it, that maybe I helped some of the guys on some level, as we benefited 1,000 times more than what we gave. And I hope that we'll be able to have a personal relationship in discussing how, hopefully, all of you will find the ways in which you can serve Klal Yisrael, hopefully formally or informally, as lay leaders, but hopefully as professional leaders. And I hope that relationship will be a strong one. And you should feel free to email me, to call me. You know, I've decided to give my life to guaranteeing the future of understanding of Yahadus that I think we all share, and hopefully we'll be able to do that together. Okay.